Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Advocacy groups have filed a federal lawsuit alleging officials at an Iowa school for juvenile offenders are failing to provide adequate mental health care. That lawsuit was filed Monday in Des Moines by Disability Rights Iowa and the national watchdog organization Children's Rights. The groups allege that officials at the Boys State Training School in Eldora administered dangerous psychotropic medications without adequate oversight and consent. Nathan Kirstein is with Disability Rights Iowa. Kirstein says the issues with the Boys Training School are much like the issues that eventually shut down the Girls Training School in Toledo, Iowa.
Many of the issues we see at the Boys State Training School are similar issues to what we saw at the Girls State Training School in Toledo. That we were involved in back the beginnings of that in fall of 2012 and through the year of 2013. That place eventually closed down. Department of Human Services operated that place as well as operated Boys State Training School. Mark Day, the superintendent at the Boys State Training School, was the interim superintendent at the Girls State Training School for most of the time that we were involved during 2013. So, you would think that similar issues, that they admitted were not, that they were not doing right and eventually led to the closure of the Girls State Training School, you would think that those issues would be resolved since it's the same players. They were not. We've been involved in the Boys State Training School since then, which led up to the report that we published in August of 2017, which revealed many of the issues that we're filing this lawsuit about this week. So when we released that report, DHS remained obstinate and did not want to seek any remedies to any of the issues and did not want to cooperate. And so this is where we're at. This is really a last resort step.
What did DHS say to you after that report was filed?
Well, what I can say is that they were not willing to work with us on any of the remedies that we laid out in the report. They said it was money issues, and that's about it.
So in this lawsuit, what are the main issues that you cite in the lawsuit?
So, lack of mental health care for those who have mental health needs. No oversight or informed consent by the parents when the youth there prescribe powerful psychotropic meds. No review procedure when it comes to prescription of psychotropic meds. Overuse of solitary confinement. Overuse of restraint, including the use of a mechanical restraint bed that has 14 restraint points on it. So with those types of issues there pointed out in the lawsuit, the types of legal allegations that we're saying is those are violations of their U.S. Constitution Eighth Amendment right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. Their substantive due process rights under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and then it's a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act.
One of the issues I've seen raised a lot has to do with that Velcro restraint. I don't know if it's a jacket or a tie-down kind of thing.
It is the mechanical restraint from bed that I just talked about. So that's a 14-point restraint bed. There's three points of restraint on each leg. So three straps on each leg, Velcro straps on each leg. Then two on each arm. One on the midsection that goes kind of over the shoulders. And then three larger Velcro wraps that go over the top to almost put you in a mummy wrap.
And this is the kind of thing to use as a last resort?
Most institutions like the State Training School are not using those anymore. So we would say that something like that should not be used. The Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, juvenile detention standards, state that mechanical restraint such as that should not be used. So we think that that's the standard of practice that we should be looking at here. Now, if they're going to continue to use it, which we say they should not, but if they did, it should be very, very limited circumstances. They've used it 107 times over 7 months in the year 2017. That's much higher than the amount they used it in 2011, that was 80, 81 times. You'd have to look at our complaint, that it was used in 2011, and the American Correctional Association, which is the accrediting body for the Boys State Training School, was concerned about the amount of use then and said they need to reduce their use of that.
When I talked to someone from the DHS this summer about some of these issues, they said that they had youthful offenders there that were sometimes violent, that were hard to deal with, and that this was always a last resort, and from, you know, other inspections from other groups that came in had not said there was anything wrong.
Number one, I'd say the other groups that are in there, I'm not sure who they were. American Correctional Association mentioned it was a problem back in their 2012 report. PREA, if you're talking about the Prison Rape Elimination Act folks, because they've touted that as something to be proud of, that they comply with the federal law. Well, that federal law has nothing to do with the use of a restraint bed such as that. They're looking at other things because it's the Prison Rape Elimination Act and seeing if they're in compliance with that. So the PREA auditors wouldn't be concerned one way or the other because they're not looking at that to begin with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And then, let's see here, you said it in terms of the most violent youth, it's being used on violent youth. The way we see it going down most often in our review of the records is oftentimes youth are put in there as a punishment or as a way to coerce them to give up their clothes to be put in suicide smocks.
What is a suicide smock?
A suicide smock is it looks almost like an apron, double apron, if you can think of something like that, that the youth has to put on if they're placed on suicide watch and it's believed that they're going to harm themselves using their clothes of some sort. So they strip down naked and then put this smock on over the top of themselves. So they're essentially naked with this smock on. And a lot of the youth there, when they're placed on suicide watch, do not want to give up all their clothing. They'll say, hey, you know, I'm not going to tie things around my neck. I'm not going to do this, but they'll still require them to take off their clothes, and if they don't, then they'll place them in the wrap until they give up their clothes or they'll cut their clothes off of them.
These seem like extreme measures for youth that seem to have a lot of mental health issues. And I think part of the disturbing part of this also is that you talk about the use of these drugs that you believe are not being dispensed properly or someone is not overseeing their use.
66% of the youth there, this is DHS's numbers, 66% of the youth at the Boys State Training School each month are on psychotropic meds. So that's a large percentage of the youth there. That's two-thirds of them. If there's two-thirds of your youth on psychotropic meds and you have no licensed mental health providers in terms of treatment, you know, in terms of providing counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, dialectical behavioral therapy, whatever that youth uniquely needs to fit their unique needs, right? If you don't have that as part of the treatment plan, then you're just drugging them. And professional standards would say time and time again there's a consensus across the nation time and time again that you do not only use psychotropic meds as your treatment regime, and that's it. It should be coupled with some type of therapy. And so, yes, that's very concerning, because then it amounts to, without oversight and without any type of additional treatment plan, it amounts to chemical straitjackets, so to speak. They're sedating them into compliance.
When I talked to you this summer and I was stating some of the reasons for the way that particular boys' home is run from the state, that they just didn't have the money, you said to me in return that this, you know, you're required by law to provide this kind of oversight and this kind of care. The amount of money you have doesn't make it so you don't have to comply with that law.
Correct. Correct. So all the legal allegations, so all the allegations in our complaint, right, they don't have what's called an affirmative defense, which means, yes, we did this, but we have a defense for it, and that is we don't have enough money. Lack of resources is not an affirmative defense to any of those legal allegations.
And I know that so far the DHS has said they don't respond to, you know, litigation that's ongoing. Where do you see this going from here?
I don't know. I don't know. I would hope that DHS sees this as a wake-up call to do what's right and follow the law and make some changes at the Boys State Training School. I think it's a couple things are important. One, this lawsuit, we're seeking class certification on behalf of all boys at the state training school now and in the future with serious mental illness. At the heart of this lawsuit is youth who have serious mental illness that are not being treated and not providing the treatment and rehabilitation services that we say our juvenile justice system is about. And if we do care about rehabilitation of our youth here in this state, then we would care very much about not only upholding the youth's legal rights, which this lawsuit is about, but also we should care about their rehabilitation because they are going to be members of our community or they will end up in prison.
That was Nathan Kirstein of Disability Rights Iowa talking about the lawsuit the organization has filed with the National Group Children's Rights against the state of Iowa over the way officials are treating youthful offenders at the Boys State Training School in Eldora. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa has a first-in-the-nation program that's aimed at decreasing dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico caused by toxic algae blooms. The program will give farmers who plant cover crops a $5 per acre discount on their crop insurance over the next 3 years. Cover crops soak up excess nutrients in the soil, especially during wet winter months when fertilizer leaches out of bare fields and into waterways. Nitrogen turns to nitrate when it hits the water, fouling drinking water sources and contributing to those algae blooms. Much of this excess fertilizer flows into the Mississippi River and then into the Gulf of Mexico, creating a dead zone each year that depletes oxygen in the water and chokes off aquatic life. The 3-year demonstration project is a partnership with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship and the USDA Risk Management Agency, which administers crop insurance. Ann Robinson is the Agriculture Policy Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Robinson says the way cover crops work to help preserve the soil and clean the water is fairly simple.
You plant small grains, which are often cereal rye or oats. Could be some brassicas like turnips. You plant them between the crop seasons to provide a living cover on fields. And numerous studies now show that the cover crops build soil health over the long run. They hold nutrients and water to prevent pollution and prevent nutrients of nitrates and dissolved phosphorus running into, leaching into our streams, groundwater, tile lines. They actually can improve wildlife habitat too, depending on, you know, the crop, to have some of that living cover on the ground during the time when the land is the most vulnerable.
So how are the cover crops good for farmers as well?
From a farmer's point of view, which Jared and I have talked about, they can also boost long-term productivity. Another way that they can help protect water is by reducing the need for some herbicides, especially when cover crops are planted before soybeans, and they can provide livestock forage. So all those things and getting livestock out on to graze on pastures is something we need more of in Iowa. Pasture-based livestock systems are one of the more sustainable ways to produce livestock and can be positive for our water quality if it's done right.
From what I've been reading, a lot of farmers in the state are beginning to take up the use of cover crops.
You know, they are increasing in the state from fewer than around 10,000 acres back in 2009. And now we have an estimated maybe 500 to 600,000 acres in 2016. So many more farmers are using them and more farmers are interested. But they can be tricky to integrate into a cropping system successfully and take some fine-tuning. So we need opportunities to encourage farmers, especially in the beginning, to try them and take those risks and work with them to figure out, you know, how to do it and how to make it work with their systems. The practices in the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, the practices that we need, it calls for about eventually saying we need 12 million acres of cover crops, or at least 50% of Iowa's corn soybean fields to have them to really have the impact that we need for water quality. So that is a lot of acres of cover crops. And to step up to the plate, we're really excited about this new tool to give a good farmer discount for farmers that plant them on new acres that are not already receiving cost share, and to get that as in the form of a discount on their crop insurance. Most farmers participate in crop insurance, so this is something that would reach a lot of farmers and might interest a lot of farmers, even though it's not a very big discount. Some surveys have suggested that this is a way that many farmers would like to receive incentives. So we want to see how it's going to work.
This is a way to make this easier in a way and do it in a way that helps them instead of saying, here are the things you have to do.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the approach to find things that we can agree on and work together on, this is one of those solutions that has a lot of support from a wide variety of players, like the Iowa Environmental Council, the Farm Bureau even, the Soybean Association, Practical Farmers of Iowa, Iowa Farmers Union. So it's something really good to be involved with. And we appreciate the leadership of the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship for making this, for working with our group that were working behind the scenes to make this happen.
That was Ann Robinson, the Agriculture Policy Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Sarah Carlson is the Cover Crop Director for the Iowa organization Practical Farmers of Iowa. She works with farmers to help them practice an agriculture that benefits both the land and people. Carlson says farmers have long used cover crops for a myriad of reasons.
We see farmers initially using cover crops because they were concerned about soil erosion on their fields, and then later, you know, about water quality issues that we have in the state of Iowa. And then as farmers have been playing around with cover crops more and kind of fitting them into their corn soybean rotation better, now farmers are seeing like reductions in expenses or increased revenues. And so that's really great. Things like better weed control in the soybean year, increased soybean yield. After a number of years of using cover crops, you see increased corn yield. And then for sure for cattle producers, which I know your area has a lot of cattle producers, we see decreases in hay expenses. So that's just really good for cattlemen to be able to control those costs when they're trying to feed cows. So, boy, it's just really now becoming a practice that's almost just an agronomic tool for our corn soybean rotation, even beyond just the conservation benefits that it can provide.
Why is it that it took so long to make this a popular thing to do for farmers?
I think probably the biggest reason is we thought we were doing all that we could to grow corn and soybeans really well. I'd say at our land-grant universities and among our ag retailers, we really thought by putting on the right pesticide program and the right nitrogen program, you know, we were doing all that we could do to grow corn and soybeans well. And then as farmers sort of questioned, you know, soil erosion on their farms, saw that and decided to cover that up, then they were able to tease out other benefits from cover crops that now, you know, a lot of farmers are seeing, like thousands in Iowa are seeing that, and now they're sharing that with their neighbors. You know, just like the popular corn hybrids that they might, you know, get yields off and they share that with neighbors. Now they're, you know, doing that with cover crop observations that they're having.
How much does this good farmer discount provide for farmers, and what's it worth for them?
So it's $5 an acre, and it's unlimited for the numbers of cover crop acres they would put on the field that are not in a cost share program, federally or state funded. So, you know, a farmer that might be doing cover crops on all their acres, let's say they're farming 2,000 acres and using cover crops on everything, you know, times $5 an acre, that's a good amount of offset for that insurance premium bill.
Right, right. Well, I understand that some people from your organization are going to go to a national conference about cover crops in Indianapolis next month.
Yeah, we are. We'll be presenting at the conference that's going to be in Indianapolis, hosted by the Soil Water Conservation Society and the Howard Buff Foundation. And we'll be presenting, and we'll also have a table there. And there are a number of really good farmer presenters and land grant researchers and ag retailers who are going to be presenting about the use of cover crops, not just for Iowa farmers, but for all farmers across really the Corn Belt.
Do you think that using cover crops and really talking about this and expanding the use, do you think it sort of helps dispel the idea that farmers don't care about, some people say, well, farmers just want to make money and run their farms. They don't care about the environment. Do you think that this helps dispel that idea some people have?
Sure. I mean, nothing speaks louder than green grass popping in the wintertime against, you know, neighboring brown fields. Nothing speaks louder that farmers really do care about their asset. And to be fair, farmers have always cared about these things. I think we just had thought we were doing all we could do. And frankly, maybe we were a little let down by the land grants and not knowing that we could do more. And so as I've seen farmers really study how cover crops can work on their farm and then get excited about growing green stuff all winter long, and they're telling their neighbors about it, you know, that's what makes farming fun again and makes us really realize that farmers have always wanted to do a good job. They just, I think, frankly, had bad advice for a long time. And now that they're really more in control and studying these things on their farm, they're seeing, actually, cover crops needs to happen. They got to do it to grow better corn and food.
So really, it's a win-win.
It is. Yeah. Now, not to say that it's easy and that the answer's in a bag. We got to be observant and manage it and be prepared in the spring and, you know, make sure we follow the right recommendations and, you know, figure that out. So it's not just plug in. We have to manage it. But once we sort of figure that out after a couple of years, then, you know, it really just becomes a normal part of our corn soybean system.
That was Sarah Carlson, the cover crop director for the Practical Farmers of Iowa. She and her colleagues are being recognized for their expertise next month at a cover crop conference in Indianapolis. listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Climate change has been blamed on many factors, from pollution to the overuse of fossil fuels. But one author says the pattern for creating this problem, and many others, was created long before we depended on oil and gas. Jeremy Lent is the author of The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. Lent says that the patterning instinct is very strong in humans, and it makes them distinct from all other animals. He says humans have a strong need to pattern metaphor and meaning into the things that surround us. And those patterns have set the stage for events that occurred hundreds and even thousands of years later.
You know, you can really call it an instinct, because even a newborn infant will, you know, and as she's there, just hearing all these sounds and feeling on all these touches, over the months, the first few months of her life, she begins to pattern meaning into this and begins to learn language and learn her own culture, without anybody telling her to do that. And, you know, we actually have that instinct all through our life. So say it's the first day in a new job and you walk into the office, and instantly you're trying to figure out, you know, who's up, who's down, what's happening, what are the ways in which things get done. And that instinct is what really has led humans, and from the earliest times in history, to try to also pattern meaning into the whole universe. So looking at the stars and looking at all the stuff that happens around, they would sort of make myths and try to understand, make stories about the universe to make it feel meaningful. And essentially that's led to human culture, which has led to all the different things that have happened in human history to the present day.
In the book, you say, you know, talking about this idea and these root metaphors that we create, that this goes all the way back to the hunter-gatherer, you know, societies way, way, way back.
Yes. And that's the thing, is that when we actually do pattern meaning into the universe, like every culture uses what I call like root metaphors to begin to make sense of things. And then sort of the new layers of meaning that get added come from that root metaphor, those root metaphors that they have. And a lot of the time those root metaphors have to do with the way in which we understand nature and our human relationship with the natural world. So all the way back to hunter-gatherer times, for example, which is essentially how humans lived for more than 95% of all of human history. And well, there, the hunter-gatherers had this root metaphor of nature is essentially like a giving mother and father. So they had this kind of almost like this family way of relating to nature. And from that, they saw spirits everywhere, and they saw themselves as being part of this family of nature. And you can kind of watch how these root metaphors change when humans first developed agriculture about 12,000 years ago, and then changed even, you know, really drastically in our Western civilization starting about 2,500 years ago. So a lot of the book actually traces how these root metaphors go from one cultural sort of complex to another, and how they affect what we actually do with our lives, how they affect how history actually sort of unfolds.
I was fascinated by the story you told in the book about comparing Christopher Columbus and a Chinese explorer who had been out exploring many years before Columbus made his journey across the sea, and how everybody knows about Christopher Columbus, but hardly anyone knows about this Chinese explorer who came before him.
Admiral Zheng, exactly. And yeah, that is just a classic example of how the different ways in which cultures make meaning out of the universe affect their values, which affects essentially how history is unfolded. So as you said, you know, we all know that Columbus discovered the New World in 1492. And what we don't know about so much is way back earlier in the 15th century, like in the 1410s and going on for decades, Admiral Zheng in China led this massive armada of about 300 gigantic ships with about something like 27,000 people in his armada. And this, just to give a sense of comparison, you could have taken one of Columbus's three boats that he used to sail to the New World, And if you'd taken those boats, you could have fit 10 of those boats into just one of Admiral Jones' boats, of which he had 300. So that gives you a sense of the massive difference in military might and kind of power. But then what's so amazing is that Admiral Jones actually, he traveled all to Africa, to India, to Arabia, but it never occurred to him to do what Columbus and the people who followed Columbus did with the New World, which was essentially was to, enslave the populations, take over the land, basically kind of steal it from the people who were living there, mine it for gold, for silver, really sort of take it for themselves and then immigrate, of course, over the centuries that followed. And so you might ask, well, why did Columbus do that and Admiral Jones did something very different? When he came across other lands and other peoples, rather than enslave them, he actually looked to, find who was the leading sort of prince in whatever area, and he'd invite some of the leading people to come back to China to sort of kowtow to the emperor and start trading relationships with them. So if you look deeper down under the layers of values, what you begin to see is that the Europeans had this belief in the driving forces of things like power and exploitation, and they felt it was completely right and natural to exploit whatever they saw in front of them and make up the rules of the game as they went along if they could. Whereas the Chinese had a belief in the universe was based on things like harmony and things being in this kind of balanced place. And so when they saw new situations, they wanted to kind of harmonize with them. So that led to these very different paths in history. You could say, well, Columbus was and the Europeans were the successful ones because they basically took over the world. And certainly that is a lesson that we can learn from that approach to power and exploitation led to so much real conquest. But then now as we look at the world right now, we can ask, are there lessons we can learn from these other ways of relating to the universe that could help us right now as we have these imbalances in the world we're looking at?
And one issue that you talk about, a big issue, is climate change. How can this different way of looking at the world help deal with that?
Yeah, and that is such an important question, of course, because as we know, climate change is getting more and more out of control. And, there's scientists all around the world sending signals that really this could be an impending threat to civilization itself if we don't bring it back into some kind of balance. And when we look at essentially this whole pattern of history from hunter-gatherer times onwards, there's something we find is that we humans, with our patterning instinct and giving us this kind of power over the rest of the natural world, have always created imbalances. So even as far back as the hunter-gatherers, before we even developed civilization, they would leave Africa and go to new continents, and they thought that the world was this giving environment. But meanwhile, their power over the other creatures led to mass extinctions of large animals in North and South America, Australia, and every new continent they went into. So one lesson we can learn is that it's actually consistent with history for humans to cause these imbalances, but now with the incredible impact humans have over the natural world, these imbalances have gotten more and more significant until they really threaten our own civilization. But then when you say, well, why, now that we know about it, we've known about climate change for decades, why don't we do something about it to bring ourselves back in balance? And that's where I think you have to look at some of the underlying root metaphors, if you will, of our modern civilization and realize that unless we change some of those metaphors, some of those ways in which we as a civilization make meaning out of our place in the universe, we're actually headed towards continuing these imbalances until really we hit a precipice. And so that's, I think, is a key finding, if you will, that comes out of this book.
It seems like a lot of these root metaphors and these instincts are almost, you know, hardwired into us. And I read a piece that you wrote about Richard Dawkins, and he's a evolutionary biologist, and he was talking to the press club, the National Press Club, about his theory about the selfish gene, and that, you know, people
right.
have this drive to do this, and it's good.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's what is so interesting, that, you know, we take really, it's become a sort of core part of mainstream thinking in the last few decades, that humans do have this kind of selfish gene, and that we are kind of hardwired to be selfish and hardwired to just kind of see the world as something to conquer. And actually, I take issue with Richard Dawkins and his selfish gene theory. And it's really not just me, but in fact, the whole generation of cognitive anthropologists and evolutionary biologists have now looked at what makes humans unique and have found that actually, rather than us having like this kind of selfish gene, we actually have more of a propensity to cooperate with each other. And in fact, if you look from a deeply biological point of view at how evolution itself works, it's not through each organism having these genes that are sort of quote unquote selfish and just trying to replicate themselves. But in addition to genes wanting to replicate themselves, there's also this way in which organisms learn to connect with other organisms and to be part of a cooperative ecosystem. And that's actually an equal part of how evolution works. So we've got what this book actually uncovers is that these ideas about the selfish gene and humans being naturally selfish and trying to just rationally optimize for themselves are actually kind of myths of meaning, if you will, that have arisen in the modern world and has been part of that kind of European mindset of conquest and exploitation, and don't necessarily, aren't in fact accurate representations of what humans are really about. But because we've just gone through generations of being told this, it essentially becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we live in a society which is set up to reward people being selfish and acting in ways to try to sort of conquer others around them. And then as they get rewarded, then we sort of think, oh, well, that proves that that's the way it is. But actually, that is not the way that humans naturally are. We're more inclined to want to be part of a community and to kind of feel good when we're actually connecting with community. And I think that by recognizing that, it gives us a much greater chance to actually shift some of the directions that our society is moving in with these imbalances, with things like climate change, another kind of environmental destruction that we're experiencing.
So I guess the question is, how do we go forward? Because a lot of people who kind of share your view about what's wrong with the world are very downhearted about the way the world is going now and feel like there's no way to turn it around.
Yes, and that's true. And I certainly share with them the feeling is that when we do look at the way some of these imbalances have gone so extreme, and it does seem like the forces of these, you know, global multinational corporations that have so much power over the world, and the forces that lead to more and more exploitation of natural resources, they do seem like they're out of control, and no matter what people say, we can't seem to put them back. But, you know, and actually in the last couple of chapters of my book, I look at the current state of the world and also trajectories to our future. And while I think that we have to be very aware of potentially devastatingly bad trajectories, we also have to recognize that the future is really non-linear. And the way that history works is not just a simple sort of straight line projection of where we see things going. But what we see is occasionally drastic changes. Called in physics phase transitions, where the whole way in which things work shift dramatically. And we saw that with the scientific revolution, for example, in Europe in the sort of 17th century. We saw that with the rise in agriculture 12,000 years ago. And many people looking at our world today, this century, see a transformation just as enormous taking place in our society. And the big question is, where is that transformation going to take us? And in fact, you know, I look at three possible trajectories, each one very different from the other. One is actually a collapse of civilization, which is terrifying to consider that as a possibility, but really has to be considered as such when we look at the facts. Another is what I call techno-split, where these incredible extreme inequalities get even more extreme as we move through this century, and even get what gets added to them is genetic inequalities, where the affluent minority learn how to genetically enhance their offspring and maybe even and get themselves like neurally connected with the internet, and the vast bulk of humans just get left behind to essentially experience their own collapse. So a real bifurcation of the human species. And there is, at the same time, this possibility for what I call a great transformation, where we could actually have a flourishing future for the world, yeah, for humans around the world. But in order to do that, we'd have to look at shifting some of our core values, values around consumerism, values around this notion of the selfish individual and each person just doing their own thing for themselves, but focusing on a sense of connection. And I think by focusing on that, on different set of values that actually are really ones that as humans we're more naturally inclined towards, we do have a possibility for a better future.
I think it's really hard for people. They're used to thinking in a linear fashion. They're taught to think that, they're conditioned to think that way when they're educated. And I think part of the issue is it's very hard for people at times to switch to another way of learning and thinking.
And it seems like it's natural when we see, if you sort of look at a graph and you see a line going in a certain direction, to think it's going to keep going in that direction. But then we can look at examples all around us of how things can change in our society so quickly that what becomes unthinkable 1 year, you know, maybe a decade or so later, suddenly becomes the norm. You know, an example that I think is very relevant is just to think about the acceptance of same-sex marriage. You know, it was really not that long ago when if people of the same sex were together, they would have thought, well, they'll never have a chance in their lifetime to actually, you know, be legally married and enjoy the benefits that come from that. And suddenly, of course, it wasn't sudden under the surface, but if we just look on the sort of surface level and see what actually happened, you see like a shift begins to take place and it's really newsworthy and exciting. And then it's almost like a house of cards, just everything like the resistance to something like that seems to just disappear, and suddenly it becomes just accepted as the norm that same-sex marriage is, you know, is what people can expect, not just in the States, but in many countries around the world. And that's the kind of shift that can happen. And the reason that can happen is that the changes are taking place sort of under the surface, if you will. So you can almost think of a sort of a network, almost like sort of tree roots or fungus in a forest, where they're connected up under the earth, and you don't actually see those connections that are taking place. And in the same way, if we just look at the headlines every day, we look at all what seems to be just one terrifying and disastrous event after another. But, you know, what you don't see are headlines saying things like, you know, well, today 20,000 people around the country became more aware of the damage arising from, you know, from our consumerist mentality and taking a different approach to things. So sort of things that are happening that are more subtle just don't get written about until it actually leads to drastic change that can sometimes be positive, doesn't always have to be negative.
That was Jeremy Lent, the author of the book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. You're listening to Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. And now we're going to talk with Allie Carson, who has a preview of this Friday night's ode.
This is our last event for the 2017 season. So, you know, if you haven't made it out to a show this year, come out.
And it's being held at
ISU Design West in downtown Sioux City. That's kind of become our home. So people, if people have been to the show before, you might have been to this building because it's a little hard to find.
Right.
It's behind Buffalo Alice and Jitters.
It's very spacious, though, downstairs where you do this. Very nice.
It's very nice. It's a very nice building.
So who can we see? Who will we hear when we go to that?
Well, we have 7 community members who will be telling true stories on stage this Friday. We have 2 returning storytellers, Sarah Cully and Patty Strong. Happy to have them back and join the lineup again. I always encourage my past storytellers to come back and do it again, and I just love it when they do because I haven't been scarred for life by public speaking and sharing some personal stories.
Which can be scary.
It can be scary. I've done it. This time I am not telling a story. Thank you to the people who have taken my place instead. I didn't want to have to tell any, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas tree kind of stories or anything like that. So, and then we have